Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash. We're building bridges.
We're joined by Professor Andrew Ross, a social activist who directs the Prison Research Lab at NYU. He's the author or editor of more than 25 books, including, most recently, The Fight Against Prison Slavery.
With Professor Ross is Dr. Tommaso Bardelli with the NYU Prison Education Research Lab, and co-author of The Fight Against Prison Slavery. And we're pleased to have with us as well Ayuba Thomas, project manager for Movements Against Mass Incarceration, an archival oral history project at Columbia University, and as well a co-author of The Fight Against Prison Slavery.
The U.S. banned slavery by ratifying the 13th Amendment. However, the amendment contains a prison slavery loophole that has been used to re-enslave hundreds of thousands within the state and federal system of mass incarceration, which grew out of chattel slavery. Talk about that form of slavery, which persists to this day, where incarcerated people work for pennies per hour or no pay under brutal conditions, and some work in former plantation fields.
It's a great pleasure to be with you, Mimi and Ken. This is Andrew Ross. I think you put your finger on one of the main goals of our book, Abolition Labor, which was to chronicle the national movement to end that exception in the 13th Amendment, to abolish that loophole that allows involuntary servitude and effectively slavery to continue behind the prison walls. Most Americans are unaware that this is constitutionally permitted, so we have to close the loophole. And so a good part of our book is chronicling that movement, of which we ourselves are participants. I would just add that it's of a particular urgency to the labor movement, because for the most part, major trade unions have not been very quick to sign on to this campaign. I hope that one of the outcomes of this book will be to persuade people within the labor movement that it's a necessary thing to do so. But the other big goal of the book really was to try and document a lot of the labor conditions behind the walls. So the bulk of the book is based on interviews with formerly incarcerated men and women in a number of states: New York, Florida, Alabama, and Georgia. And we wanted to get the full spectrum of the kinds of jobs that people do, and also the conditions that they labor under, and the violence that is always there, that is omnipresent, that forces them to work, and provide a kind of holistic picture of what it's like behind the walls. So I guess these are the two main goals of the book in many ways. Tommaso or Ayuba, do you want to add to that or embellish it in any way?
Sure, yeah, I can add a little bit, and thank you, Mimi and Ken, for adding us. I think Andrew really summarized the core of the book, but something else you will find in it, and hopefully it'll be helpful and interesting to you all. We try to document all the work that incarcerated people do on behalf of not just the state and in a few cases, private industries, about around 3% of people incarcerated in US prisons work for private corporations. So most of them actually work for the prison system itself. And we show how their work has become really essential to run these institutions, like the institutions that detain them, that punish them, that abuse them in many cases, rely on their labor just to, get by operationally and maintenance-wise. And that includes both the labor they do formally, so they assign to kitchen tasks and laundry and groundskeeping and everything else you can imagine to run facilities that hold thousands or tens of thousands of people sometimes, but also all the labor they do informally just to keep themselves alive. So the book detail really the condition of life in these institutions that, as we know, has grown out of control over the past few decades, but at the same time have dedicated a smaller and smaller part of the budget to keep people alive. And so we detail kind of the struggle and the efforts that people have to make just to keep alive, often against the rules of the institution themselves, to find food, to trade food, to sell food, or donate food to one another. So that's what you'll find in the central part of the book, in a way. So condition of formal labor, but also condition of informal labor, and all the things people have to do just to stay alive in this institution that detain them, but they do not take care of them by any stretch of imagination.
Yuba, I think the torch was handed to you.
Thank you, Mimi. I appreciate you and Kent for having us here on the show today. So, an aspect of the book I would like to touch on is the fact that we use actual interviews. So, these are real stories. These are actual people who've experienced these things. And these are stories that are most likely not told in other situations. Our research is predicated on the information we gather from our interviews, but as well as documentation and other resources like Marshall Project reviews and things of that nature. I really think that it's important to tell these stories because a lot of people from that culture, people, brown and black people, formerly incarcerated people, haven't had the right to speak their history, haven't had the right to archive their history. So what we're doing is we're giving them a voice. And like Andrew said, a lot of people just don't know about what's going on a political level, inside of institutions, and on a social level, what transpires from people going to institutions. I think that we've reached a lot of points, and we're able to note what's happening nationally, not just here in New York, but what's happening all throughout the nation, and all the strides and the moves and organizational movements, litigation, legislation, to change these situations that people are very not aware of. So we're just happy to be here and be able to bring notoriety to a subject that is not really spoken about and not really known about in the general public
Well,
too
let me
often.
ask you this. In law, there's an expression in Latin, res ipsa loquitur. The thing speaks for itself. So I'm wondering if one of you might be able to read a passage from The Fight Against Prison Slavery, co-authored again by Ayuba Tomaso and Andrew. Set the table further for our discussion on the fight to end prison slavery. Andrew, might you be able to take that task up?
I think Tommaso might.
Okay.
Field and factory. Much of the testimony we gathered included accounts of extreme cruelty and barbarism. Texas is one of the seven states, along with Arkansas, Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Mississippi, and South Carolina, where zero compensation is offered for the vast majority of prison labor. It is also one of the southern prison systems where it is terrible. So I'm going to read a quote from page 12 in our book, Abolition Labor. This is about Donna Fairchild. She's a native Texas who worked in a managing factory plant before she was incarcerated. And she just pretty much told us what it was like to be assigned to work in the fields. This is the quote. When I was 30 years old, I went in when I was 30 years old, and they said, "You look young enough and healthy enough. We're going to put you on the whole squad." They call you out at 6 a.m. And if it's very much like an old prison movie scene where you might have seen armed guards on horseback watching us. We were doing identical work to the plantation. We might have been we might have had a big hoe or even a sledgehammer because we also broke rocks. It was like a chain gang, but we weren't chained together. We worked year round during the coldest and the hottest. There was one time where we were harvesting cabbage in February, and some rows were even flooded, and it was 31 degrees. Texas policy is that inmates don't work outside if it's below freezing, and they aren't provided with things to keep them warm. Everyone was miserable, shivering, trying to get it done fast, because the lieutenant told us if we got all the cabbage picked, we would go back in. I don't know if you ever pick cabbage. You have to like twist it so it breaks off and it has a bottom plant. If you pull up the whole plant, you're gonna get a disciplinary ticket because you can't grow another head of cabbage. So you have to hold down the bottom of the plant with your knees and twist. Everyone was wet from the knees down. And I remember asking that they don't really care about what happens to me. I felt like I could have died and they would not have cared.
Wow. Thank you, Ayuba.
Andrew, what did you learn from the thoughts, concerns, and oftentimes actions, including prison strikes, from those behind the walls?
That's a good question, Ken. One of the things we tried to document in the book, because we spent quite a bit of time in Alabama, was the extent of the prisoner strikes that really ran in their heyday from 2014 through really 2020, I guess was the last large one. Sorry, 2022. And as it happened, Alabama prisons were the epicenter of that movement. They were national in scope, and they, some estimates have about as many as 50,000 prisoners participating. They were work strikes, labor strikes, and it was specifically chosen to be labor strikes because the idea was really to focus on the vulnerability of the system, which depends entirely, as Tommaso earlier pointed out, on the labor of incarcerated people. And if you withdraw that labor, the prison doesn't really function. It can't function for very long. So these were strategic strikes, and they were enormously influential in their day. There was, of course, a lot of repression that followed in their wake. We've been trying to chart the legacy of that movement. There have been efforts in the last year or so to revive the movement. But it was a very instructive period, and it wasn't well documented. So one of the things we thought we really needed to do in the book, since we were in Alabama anyway, was to try and get some testimony from people who'd been involved both within the prison walls and also outside.
You know, one of the things that I'm interested in is if any one of you can talk about the system of forced labor, prison labor, which feeds and actually grows the prison system. What's in it for the prisons and the state? How do we understand this as a labor question in a systemic way? Which one of you or all of you can talk about what this means, why we have this a system? I mean, obviously there's the issue of racism, but it seems to me that it's about racial capitalism. How does the prison labor system and the state actually benefit from its mistreatment and exploitation of people behind the walls?
Thank you, Mimi. I think this is a great question. I can say just a little bit about it, and then I'll let Ayuba and Andrew integrate. But so I think there is not just one answer to this. It is definitely, as you say, a system of racial capitalism. The state, mostly, sometimes private actors, but mostly the state, is extracting profit of these people. There are billions of dollars every year of unpaid wages that would be owed to these workers if they were paid anything near minimum wage for their work. As Andrew was saying, incarcerated workers are actually running and doing all the work to run in the prison and keep the prison system afloat. So again, there are billions of dollars extracted from them in unpaid wages. So I think that's a part of the question. It's a part of the answer. Like, you know, this is unpaid labor to run a system, to run the prison system. There are correctional industries, so-called, that are owned by states. There is one also owned by the federal government for Unicor, and they are making actual profit. They are paying people pennies to do manufacturing and service work, your license plates in New York, DMV call centers, several products across different states that are sold mostly to state agencies. So it is a real profit made off them. They're not paid real wages, but these the goods they produce are sold on markets and sold for real dollars. And then I think the most perverse, maybe part of the answer is that a system like the one you heard about in Texas is actually not producing any profit. Like Texas puts a lot of effort in creating this inhumane agricultural system. They're not making any money out of that. They're losing money by running the system. So it really kind of bears the question of why they would go to such real length just to keep people in those, again, inhumane and barbaric conditions. And again, I think in the book we offer the beginning of an answer, and it is a legacy of slavery. It is about power. It is about a state caring to punish people and to make sure they know that the state owns them, sometimes even more, even more than they care about making money off them. So again, I would say not a single answer. There is a part of it that is extraction and is racial capitalism, and then there is a part of it that is like an obsession with punishment and kind of showing power, sometimes even at the cost of money and taxpayers' dollars.
Ayuba has some personal experience of this, so if he wants to talk about this, but before that, I just want to add a historical note, which is that in the public mind, when most people think about the worst forms of coerced labor, they think about convict leasing in the South. But in actual fact, and this is something that we document in the book, all of the components of the convict leasing system were pioneered in northern states, especially in New York State, in a very brutal industrial system of private contract prison labor during the 19th century. And the fledgling labor movement actually cut its teeth on opposition to the use of unfree labor in prisons and won its first major victory through the abolition of private contracted labor. First in New York, but then in a series of other states, and ultimately led to the demise of convict leasing in the South. But after that abolitionist moment, which is very important and is not well known about, the labor movement moved on and focused on sweatshops in the garment industry as a new evil, a new demon that had to be exorcised. And ever since then, as I said at the beginning, we've seen a certain distance between the labor movement and this issue of prison labor. And that's unfortunate because there's nothing in a way that would hold back trade unions from joining in that fight. So I just wanted to add that historical note because abolition has happened before. In a very big way in northern states and in southern states, in private contract labor, but not in the use of that labor for the public benefit, for government agencies and the like. Ayuba, do you want to speak a little bit about the use of force or the experience of the use of force?
Yeah, for sure. So I look at it like it's a complete system. And it's the reason we even started doing this work, particularly on labor, is because we realized the extractive nature of the prison complex, how it takes people away. And on top of taking people away, it takes resources from the community. So we looked at it in the sense of if the people who are already missing a piece of their community, a piece of additive to the community, whether it be spiritual, financial, or just a physical, presence, you're taking that away, but then the family has to then, try to scrounge to compensate, one, for the loss of this person who was an additive, but then two, to make sure and ensure that this person comes back safe and sound and healthy, right? So a lot of finances are drawn out of the community. And so if we looked at it in the sense that if the people were actually paid for the labor that they do on the inside, it will be a lot helpful for the people outside as well as the people on the inside. Not only would this labor, this payment that they have for labor, set them up or sustain them while they're in prison, but it will actually give them a head start, you know, when leaving prison. So back to your question, Mimi, it's really a thing of continuing the perpetuation of the system, right? So you have to have, in order for the system to work in prison, you have to have bodies. So the bodies have to come from somewhere. They draw them from specific communities. And when they do that, it affects, you know, not only, you know, the like I said, the physical presence of it, but it's an economic presence and an economic withdrawal. So the book touches on that also. And I think that, like Tommaso was saying, it's there are actors that benefit from this on both parts, from extracting people from the community and the free labor that they'll get.
And what did it feel like? And what did it mean for the people that you interviewed, the interviews and the recitation of these terrifying stories of abuse, dangerous conditions, hazardous conditions, and the horrible exploitation that is endemic to this labor question? People behind the walls who do the work, it is a labor question as well as any labor question, which is also an issue of control. Your thoughts on that, Ayuba, as well. And then if we could all just take up, as time grows near, what the movement to abolish forced labor, again, much of it unpaid in American prison, what does the new prisoner rights movement look like? So if you could talk to that question about the experiential element of dealing with people behind the walls, and then what is to be done? What's that movement look like, which is coming from inside the walls itself?
For sure. So another particular aspect of the book that's a little bit unique is that I myself have lived experience. So I was behind the wall. So hearing these stories, it jogged recollection of what I went through and the pain and the suffering and the fear of brutality and repercussions for not working, you know? There was one particular guy I spoke to in Georgia, and he was an elderly gentleman, and similarly to Debbie that I spoke about earlier, he was put on like the side of the road to clean up the side of the road. And in Georgia, the conditions in the summertime could reach up to 110 degrees with no, you know, even though there's trees and stuff like that, there's really barely any shade. So he was telling about how he had to walk as I think he was about 76 years old, and he had to walk 3 miles to the site with boots that did not fit his feet. That was just like, you know, heart-wrenching. You know, I didn't go through that experience personally, but, you know, I can attest to seeing people who were walking around the prison without things that were fitting. You know, their clothes didn't fit. Their shoes didn't fit. How do you do this type of labor with things that, and you're supposed to be provided, you know, with the bare essentials, but the bare essentials aren't even for you. This is for someone else to do labor on top of that. Those stories, you know, the situations that people were put in is just like horrific. So like, I'm just so grateful that we're even given this opportunity to bring the situation to light and, hopefully get some kind of, feedback and response from people out there, you know, to this horrific thing that's going on right now.
Just to wind up, Mimi, in response to your question about the, you know, next steps, the national movement currently in state after state is focused on, you know, passing constitutional amendments that abolish slavery without exception. There's 7 states so far that have done that. There hasn't been a lot of appreciable change on the cell block itself. And that's why, and there's been a lot of litigation, therefore, that has had to follow on from the constitutional amendment. So we're thinking in many ways about trying to remodel that approach. In New York State, the coalition that we're part of, 13 Forward, also is focused on a bill. Passing a bill that that includes the minimum wage, the right to organize, establishing a prison labor board to monitor conditions, introducing workplace protections, and so on and so forth. In other words, a standard labor package. That's the kind of approach we think is required at this point, and we think is appropriate. And from our interviews, we've come to realize that it's the kind of approach that would be appreciated by people who are behind bars and also the formerly incarcerated and their families, because as Tommaso pointed out, a lot of the burden of supporting people who are getting ultra low pay and working under these forced conditions falls on their families and the communities from which they've been extracted.
Through the voices and analyses of imprisoned workers themselves, the fight against prison slavery makes a powerful case that abolition is a labor question, as a good friend, the people's historian Robin Kelly, offers.
Well, the fight against prison slavery is a must read and to act on. Ayuba Thomas, Tommaso Bardelli, Andrew Ross, you have to come back again. This is just part one of this critical, critical story. It is a human rights question. It is a question of eliminating the loophole in slavery. Maybe it's even a question of, as we've once looked at, the issue of forming cooperatives so that people can come out while we still have this carceral system with something concrete. But for sure, it is a labor question, and we want to encourage everybody to read The Fight Against Prison Slavery. Ayuba Thomas, Tommaso Bardelli, Andrew Ross, you will come back again, won't you?
You sure will.
Thank you.
Yes, we will.
Well, as they say,
thank you for having us.
Onward ever, backward never. Thank you. It's entirely our pleasure. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we continue to build bridges, not walls. Thanks for listening, and educate, agitate, and organize. Thank you.